This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
This morning on the Saturday Breakfast Show, we are talking about books. We are talking about why they are important, why literacy is important, and why it's not just enough to say, oh, you have to read, but to actually think about why that reading is so vital for our children.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Hey, very good morning to you. This is Saturday, the 9th of March, 2024. Welcome to the Saturday Morning Breakfast Show here on Teachers Talk Radio. In case you are new to the show, my name is Darren Lester. I am a teacher of classics and foreign languages. And I come to you every Saturday morning, well, almost every Saturday morning, apart from the Saturdays where I am in school, of course, to talk about all things educational. We have here on the Saturday Morning Breakfast Show a particular interest in books, in literatures, in stories. And so quite often that is where our shows go, and today kind of fits into that mold. We also have an interest here in pedagogy, in the science of teaching. And quite often that's what our shows are about. But today, as we are on the tail end of Book Week, as many schools tend to use for World Book Day, which was of course on Thursday, we are turning ourselves back round into literacy today. We are turning ourselves back into books, back into stories, to think about exactly why they are important. Because I think quite often, and again, this is where I'm going to get on my soapbox a little bit, because, you know, I always do. I have this platform. I'm allowed. It's very easy, I think, in teaching and in all professions, really, because, again, I do like to remind our listeners that not everybody who is part of the Saturday Morning Breakfast Show family is a teacher. I believe everybody that tunes in is involved with children in some way, but I know that we have children's literature enthusiasts quite often like to listen in. I know that I have writers as part of my audience. I know that I have academics as part of the audience. So not everybody here is a teacher. And I think in all professions, it is very easy to do things just because that's the way they are done, to prioritize things because those are the things that are prioritized, and just to kind of follow the party line. But I think if we do that, then we do ourselves and our industry a bit of a disservice, because it means that nothing will ever get better. If you always do the same thing, then nothing will ever change. And there's almost an arrogance to that, I think, because there is almost a way, it feels like we're saying, oh, we don't need to change. We are perfect as we are. You know, the system is working. We don't need to do a deep dive into anything because it's great. And the fact of the matter is, there is always room for improvement. And as teachers, we know that because we say that to our kids every single day. And yet we don't seem to take that into account in our practice, in our offerings, in what we do on a day-to-day basis. I think part of that can be fear. The unknown is scary. The future is scary. You will remember, those of you who are long-term friends of the show, that a couple of weeks ago I did a reflection on the interviews that I have recently done. If you've not listened to that show, please do go back and take a listen, because I've had some really positive feedback on it. People have messaged me to say, you know, they listened to it before going into their own interviews and taken some hints and tips from my experiences. So it does seem to be a show that that does what it set out to do. And I haven't made a decision yet, quite honestly, on whether I'm going to take any of the jobs that I have been offered as a result of those interviews. Now, again, if you haven't heard that show, I don't need a new job. I'm very, very happy in my school. I'm not actively looking. I kind of went through the process because it's been a few years since I have done interviews, and I kind of just wanted to see what was out there, see whether I am still marketable, see whether I am still hireable. And I think one of the reasons that I haven't made a decision on any of those jobs, and why I've kind of even put off thinking about it, is that it's quite scary to think about what happens one way or the other. You know, what happens if I accept a new job and I leave my current setting where I am? Like I said, I am happy. I love my colleagues. They are fantastic. My children are incredibly funny. You know, there are so many positives. So what happens if I leave that job and I'm not as happy in whichever one I go into next? But conversely, what if I stay where I am because I am happy and I miss a big opportunity by not taking that leap? Not being able to see into the future is really difficult. It's very annoying. I do wish that if we assume for sake of argument that evolution is a thing, I do wish that by now we had evolved to be able to see the future, because that would make decision-making ever so much easier. But I do think that fear of the unknown, like I was saying before, is one of the reasons that we don't interrogate practice and we don't interrogate norms as often as we think we should. I proposed a piece of action research in my setting last week, the week before, and it was approved. You know, our deputy head academic said, yep, that's great. But as part of my research plan, he did make me kind of commit to writing the fact that because I was changing up my practice, I couldn't guarantee any kind of results. You know, I couldn't say this class will be as successful in their learning as my previous classes have been because I'm changing the way that I'm doing things. And I thought that was a really interesting way to spin it. That was a really interesting way to think about it, because there was no commitment to writing that they might do better. There was no commitment to writing that the change might actually be a positive. There was only the caveat that there might be a negative to it. There might be a downside to it. And I know that human brains are wired to spot patterns. That is part of our evolution. That is part of how we came to be. It's why we see faces in all sorts of strange things. And I think if you have classes that have done well year after year after year, it's very easy to spot that pattern and say, well, clearly the constant is me and my teaching, therefore what I'm doing works. And I think the moment you go, what I'm doing works, is the moment that you stop looking for other things. Because it's good enough, it's okay to say, yes, this works. And you kind of stop looking for better. And that's not what I want to encourage here on Saturday Morning Breakfast. You know, while we are sitting and having our breakfast together, I want us to think about how we can be better. How we can be better teachers, how we can be better writers, how we can be better readers. You know, whatever it is that we do for a living, how can we be better? Because I think if we stop trying to be better, then we just start stagnating. And I don't really see then kind of what happens for us for the next 40, 50 years, if we're just kind of content as we are. So that's kind of the basis of today's show. We are looking at why literacy is important. It is, you know, that's going to be my starting point. And I'm going to sit here and acknowledge that there is probably some confirmation bias in my research today. But you know, again, like I've said, it's not enough to sit and say, yep, literacy is important. Yep, numeracy is important. We need to think about why, because it is in thinking about why that we can think about how to promote it, that we can think about how to make it part of our everyday practice, and that we can really get to grips with what it is that we are doing. I suppose part of my interest in action research, in educational pedagogy, in thinking about my practice, is that interrogation. It is that thinking of why, so that we can make it more deliberate. Deliberate practice is a buzzword. It comes round every 2 or 3 years. Nobody ever tells us what it actually means. We're just told that our practice must be deliberate. But I do think, for me, the way that I've interpreted deliberate practice is getting to grips with the why you are doing what you are doing. Not just parroting the party line, yes, literacy is important, yes, we are going to do our written feedback, yes, I've spoken to you about your work, so it's vital that I give you a verbal feedback given stamp. But we think about why we do those things. And if there is no clear why, then we need to change them, because we haven't got the time to waste. One of the big gripes that we all have as teachers is our limited amount of time. And so if we're then just doing things for no real reason, we are wasting the limited amount of time that we have.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This week in the news. Is World Book Day a burden on parents? Has the tide turned against hyper-discipline in schools? Is Scotland going to be excluding more students? Should we be talking up the benefits of going to school at a school that is turning the clock back on mobile phones? World Book Day on March the 7th has become a fixture in the school calendar, where pupils are encouraged to come to school dressed as their favourite characters, or bring books to donate or tell their friends about. This celebration of reading, though, has become a little controversial, as reported in the BBC and The Guardian. Parents have complained of increasing pressure to buy commercialised costumes or spend time and money elaborately creating their own. Some of the pressure has a class element, with some parents sending their children to school dressed as characters from Harry Potter, while others might be the Artful Dodger. Head teacher Fran Davis from Michigan Primary School in Mountain Ash has said she wants the day to be fun without being a financial burden. Therefore, she suggests that pupils can come in their pajamas, suggesting their favourite bedtime book, or simply in school uniform, as they might be pupils at Hogwarts or even Greyfriars. If you wish to hear teachers' views on World Book Day, listen to last week's Late Show with Lucy Neuberger on Teachers Talk Radio. One of the most significant developments in education in the last few decades has been the trend towards positive discipline, or military-style discipline, in schools. And this provides the context for the next two stories this week. The first story appeared on the BBC and was covered by the Guardian newspaper. And it's about the Michaela School, led by the controversial head teacher, sometimes described as Britain's strictest head teacher, Catherine Birbal Singh, who has been in the news for the school's policy towards Muslim prayers. Half of the pupils of the school are Muslim students. Two students have given interviews where they describe a toxic atmosphere of the school and an atmosphere of fear and being stripped of their identity. If you wish to learn more of this story, you can find Tom Rogers' interview with Catherine Birbal Singh on this topic on Teachers Talk Radio. The increasing prevalence of tiger-style teaching, strict discipline methods, zero tolerance, and first-time, every-time expectations of students across British schools was highlighted when a parent at Boston Spa Academy complained her autistic son found school intolerable, as over a period of only a few days, he acquired 56 negative comments and several days in isolation. Boston Spa Academy schools have appeared frequently in Education Uncovered and other news outlets for their strict approach involving lining up for inspections and an expectation that rules will be obeyed instantly and at all times. Not for the first time, teachers' unions have described these policies as inhumane. This week, Scotland's Education Secretary, Jenny Gilruth, announced that there would be a review of Scottish Government's policy on exclusions. The number of exclusions from schools has dropped considerably in recent years, as a determined policy of avoiding school exclusion was adopted following research of a link between excluded students and later involvement in crime. However, with one-third of teachers in Scotland reporting in a survey of the EIS Union that they had suffered assault or physical violence in the previous year, pressure to review the non-exclusion policy has resulted in a reconsideration. School attendance is once again in the news. A survey revealed that nearly a third, 32% of teachers and school leaders have experienced pupils being absent this academic year because of a parental dispute with the school. The survey, by Teacher Tap, asked 8,411 teachers and leaders in state schools in England in January what reasons they had been given for pupils missing school this academic year, other than illness. More than half, 51%, said pupils had been kept home because they were tired after an event the night before. Nearly 9 out of 10, 87%, said wanting to take a holiday during term time was the reason, while more than 3 in 4, 76%, pointed to family events. John Camp, president of the Association of School and College Leaders, warned in a speech to the union's annual conference that the unwritten social contract between families and schools is fracturing, and he called for a change of tone in the national conversation about education to ensure that people talk up schools and colleges. And finally, another story from the BBC, where Milldown Academy in Blandford Forum head teacher Mr. Law has adopted the policy of providing brick phones, old-fashioned simple mobile phones for students. Parents can hire or borrow them as an alternative to smartphones, which are increasingly distracting in the school. You can find more discussion of these and other stories on Teachers Talk Radio or reviewed each Sunday on Teachers Talk Radio panel, which you can find the links to on YouTube or the Teachers Talk Radio site. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio news with John Gibbs.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
Our thanks to John for filling in and taking on the news this week while Joe has had a diocese inspection. Joe, if you are listening, and I hope you're not, I hope that you are still in bed recovering. I hope that went well. Soapbox time. Again, I think I'm just going to make Saturday morning soapbox a thing, quite honestly, because I do seem to get on my soapbox every time we hear the news. And let's be frank, most weeks before I even press play on the news. I don't like when kids come to school in their pajamas. I really don't. I find that so, so uncomfortable. I think... We've talked on the show before about the performativity of identity, and I did one of my very first shows actually was on the concept of teacher identity and about how what we wear to school helps to create that persona. You know, I talk quite openly about the fact that while I hate wearing a tie, putting on my tie turns me from Darren into Mr. Lester. I don't wear a tie anywhere else other than when I'm at school, so it is part of that performativity of the Mr. Lester character. And I think, you know, we know that there are different types of dress for different occasions, and all schools have very strict uniform policies for children and for staff about what is and is not appropriate to wear. But for some reason, we decide that when it comes to randomly wearing your pajamas to school for absolutely no reason, that's okay. And I just find that really strange. I find that it goes against so much of the safeguarding stuff that we talk about and that is so important. I think it goes against the idea of professionalism, being in a professional setting. And I just find it a bit strange. I'm not going to lie, I just find it a bit strange. So I'm going to suggest that, yes, you know, I understand, I'm not a parent, but I do understand that there, many parents do find it a financial burden to dress their child up for World Book Day. You know, I get that. I understand that there can quite often be competition between parents for who has made the best costume. Actually, that would be a really interesting study, and maybe one of our listeners knows that somebody has done it. But I wonder whether, with the rise of parental WhatsApp groups and kind of parents being just as much in touch with each other these days as our kids are, has there been a rise in parental competition? Has there been a rise in parental pressure and parental stress around these types of events? Because they feel like they know each other more. You know, gone are the days of 5-minute conversations on the playground while you're dropping the kids off, and then you go off on your separate ways until 3:25 when you pick them up, and your school mum, your school dad friends are people that you see for 10 minutes every day. You can now be in constant communication with them. And quite often you're expected to be in constant communication with them. I've heard parents report that they have felt excluded, they felt isolated if they didn't want to be in the parental WhatsApp groups. So, you know, I do understand that, and I do understand the idea that sending your kids to school in pyjamas that all kids have is a cost-effective way to do that. I just am not, honestly not sure if it's appropriate. And as a teacher, I don't like it. I feel very uncomfortable. I refuse. If staff are allowed to wear their pyjamas to school, I refuse, because I don't think that's appropriate for me. And I don't like kids. No, that came out way wrong. I don't like teaching kids when they are in their pajamas. There we go. Just have a regular non-uniform day. If you want to promote World Book Day and make it fun, but you don't want to put the expense of dressing children up on the parents, make it a non-uniform day if you must. There's no need for it to be. It can just be a regular uniform day. But And you know, this might sound a bit radical, I'm going off-piste here. Let's put the literacy at the centre of World Book Day instead of the dressing up. Now, you know, this is not me being anti-dressing up. As I've mentioned once or twice on the show before, I am a former performer. I am a former West End actor, so I am very, very much au fait with dressing up. So I am not against it at all. I just think that there is a time and a place for certain things, for certain outfits, for certain types of clothing. And I think schools quite often, without meaning to, start to blur the boundaries and undermine their own policies when they say, yeah, come in your pajamas, it's fine. That's the end of that particular soapbox, I think. But I wanted to climb aboard because it is relevant to what we are talking about today, which is, why is literacy important? Now, literacy and reading and English and language, it quite often gets downplayed when the government talks about levelling up. To use a phrase I actually quite like, I'm a casual video gamer,
I'm looking at my Nintendo Switch down on the floor. Other video game systems are available. And I haven't picked it up for about 3 months. And so, you know, I like the idea of leveling up in games. I like the idea of upskilling. I've been looking at a couple of upskilling courses this week to do alongside my doctorate. You know, I'm very much about us being the best people we can be. But when the government talks about leveling up, it talks about STEM. And as I've said before, I'm not here to downplay the importance of STEM. I am not here to say that STEM is not important, because it is. However, it's not the only thing that's important. And as many of us in the arts and in the humanities say so frequently, STEM is often promoted at the expense of the arts and the humanities. And so, you know, I'm not here to say that we shouldn't be teaching our children science and tech and maths. I am saying that we should teach that those skills are just as important as the literacy skills, the artistic skills, the humanities skills, and they should be on a par. And I do feel that languages and literacies have declined in importance. They are being made to feel less important than they have been previously. It is kind of like John was saying in the news about having to reframe the conversation about the importance of schooling and to really show our young people that education is important. And that comes from the conversations that adults are having. It comes from the conversations and the attitudes of their parents. And it's the same with promoting literacies. It's not about all of a sudden saying, don't study maths, study fine art. It's about saying, yes, you can study maths if you want to, but you could also study fine art. Do which one is going to most enrich your life and work for your future. So that's kind of the crux of today. We want to get to the bottom of why literacy is so important. I've got my studies for you. I have got my research. You know, don't worry. I have got all of my evidence-based practice for today. But the most important thing that I think I can do to convince you of why literacy is important, going beyond just the passive, yes, it is, and into why, is an actual case study of an actual country that realized that literacy there was a problem. So we're going to turn and look at China for a few minutes. Because in the 1920s, China started what was called its Cultural Revolution. China changed as a country completely. It had previously been one of the poorest countries. It was a farming-heavy country. It was an insular country. And it pretty much, lifestyle pretty much boiled down to working on your family's farm to grow the food to feed your family. And there was that kind of, that repetition, I guess, in life of self-sufficiency. But China as a country very quickly realized that it needed to start competing. You know, the world was opening up at this point in time. Asia was opening up to Europe at this point in time. And China was looking at other countries and seeing the kinds of quality of life that other countries had and saying, this is something that we want. This is something that we need for our people. And so they began to look at what was going on in their country. And they were trying to see what was going wrong. And, you know, this actually led to some very interesting things to read about, although some, I feel, quite misguided ideas, because what they ultimately decided was that it was the traditional culture and values of China that were wrong. And they were being used as a scapegoat for what people were seeing as the problems in the country. So there was a big effort to try to introduce secularism to the country and begin to stamp out traditional religion, Confucianism, and philosophy. They were seen as being old-fashioned. They were seen as being part of the old China, and they wanted to change that. It's why even today, you know, the party line is there is no religion in China. That is still seen as being a positive in moving the country forward. What they also did, and this is something that I do agree with, is they looked at their literacy and illiteracy rates. Now, for anybody who doesn't read Chinese, you might look at Chinese characters and go, yeah, okay, actually, I understand why in the 1920s and the 1930s there might have been higher literacy in China, because this is really hard to read. I, as a language teacher, would turn around and say, yeah, that's because you haven't learned how to read it. But that's by the by. Because the fact is, it was hard to read. It was hard to read. And that was one of the issues that people were having. They weren't able to access any of the Western literature in translation that was starting to happen. They weren't able to access any of the university books. Of course, this is not all Chinese people. There was a subset of educated Chinese, mostly men, let's be honest, but men and women, who were able to read and write fluently. But it was a very low percentage. China at this point had a very low literacy rate. So one of the things they started to do was to reform their writing system, to simplify it. And that's where simplified characters have come from. So in case you're not sure about Chinese, in case you've never studied Chinese, the Chinese writing system has two very separate sets of characters. There are what we call traditional characters, which tend to be associated with Cantonese language. And then there are the simplified characters that tend to be associated with Mandarin language. It's not quite that cut and dry, but for the sake of this conversation, that's the distinction we'll make. So the traditional characters, as their name implies, are the ones that were used for all of Chinese for literally thousands of years, up until the 1920s, up until people said, no, this is really difficult to read. These characters are very complex, they are hard to remember, they are hard to write. And, you know, as one of my lecturers at uni told us a year ago, you should never read anything without writing about it, because quite often it's through writing that we process our thinking. So they started this change, this simplification of their writing system. They didn't change the actual language. The grammar remained the same. The vocabulary remained the same. And actually Chinese, Mandarin, I will say Mandarin because I don't speak Cantonese. I understand, but I don't speak. Mandarin vocabulary and grammar is relatively straightforward compared to many other languages. It was literally just the writing system that they started to change. They experimented as kind of a thought experiment with the idea of introducing Roman characters, the English alphabet, what in Mandarin studies these days we call pinyin. And they kind of thought about introducing that as the official spelling. But that was very quickly discounted, because there still needed to be this Chinese identity to the reading and writing system. So they simplified the characters. And many of them remained the same. Many, many simplified and traditional Chinese characters are the same. But they also made a lot of them, particularly the more common words and the more common sounds, much easier to identify and, more importantly, easier to write. Quicker to write. And as we have seen in the 100 or so years since that happened, China as a country has boomed. You know, we now think about China when we think about technological innovation. China for a long time had the most billionaires in the world. It has recently been overtaken again by the US, but it did for a long time. So it has become, in just 100 years, this very prosperous country. And this is a country that looked at its low literacy levels and said, this is a problem, let's actually do something about it. Now, again, I have oversimplified a very complex, very controversial historical issue just for the sake of my argument here that literacy is important. So if you are interested in the Chinese Cultural Revolution, do go and read up on it. It is, I find it fascinating. I'm not a modern history person, you know, I'm a classicist. My expertise in history fall apart along with the Roman Empire, quite frankly. But I do like that period in Chinese history because of the very, very rapid change that the country underwent. But that, you know, that is a pinnacle, that is an example of why literacy is important, because it can literally change the fabric of a country. It can change what people can achieve. It can change, again, not just individual lives, but an entire state. And again, if we think about a country as huge as China, and there is big disparity across the country, there is still a lot of poverty that offsets the number of billionaires. You know, I'm not saying that there isn't. I'm not saying that it's some kind of utopia of literary academics. I am just saying that on a structural level and on a general level, this increase in literacy rates has been very, very helpful in the success of the country. And that's something that I think the British government, again, is getting wrong, because our whole levelling up strategy has been about pushing STEM. And one of the things that we need to be doing is looking at our literacy. Because again, if children are not reading, then they are not accessing knowledge. When we go to universities, we go to lectures. The word lecture comes from the French word lecture, which means reading. Because while we might think of a lecture these days, and in English we use lecture to mean somebody speaking at you with no interaction, it's actually about the reading. It's about the reading that you did outside of class that you then go and talk about with your lecturer, or your lecturer talks about with you, or reads out to you, or whatever it might be. But it's about engaging with the reading. There is knowledge in books. It's why the burning of the Library of Alexandria was such a huge loss to humanity at large, because books are where our knowledge is kept. And while we are now getting used to, you know, I, as an older millennial, I have seen this in my lifetime, where people online have gone from long-form blogging. I miss blogs. They were so good. But long-form blogging through to short-form blogging was quite popular for a while, through to micro-blogging on Twitter. And so now, if something is longer than 240 characters, people don't really want to read it. We've seen the same happen with YouTube, with video content, where we saw YouTube videos, long YouTube videos, go through to, I can't remember which came first, either Instagram Reels or YouTube Shorts. For me, they're interchangeable. You know, at 5 minutes long, through to TikTok videos at 30 seconds long. I'm surprised we haven't seen the same with podcasts yet. I am surprised that I get away with having an hour and a half of airtime every Saturday morning. But I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a change in the way podcasts work to become short form content, because that is the way that everything has been pushed. And our children know that. I had a year nine child say to me yesterday, oh, you know, it's not really my fault that I can't concentrate because TikTok has trained my attention span to be only for a few seconds. And, you know, this is the great thing that kids do when they cherry pick the knowledge that they have. Because I was able to turn around to him and say, yeah, if TikTok has trained your attention span to be about 30 seconds long, then we can untrain it to be 30 seconds long and train it to be longer. But this move to short form content has meant that people are not used to consuming longer form stuff, and we need to get them back to consuming it. We need to make longer form content the norm again, so that we can train them, so that we can retrain all of our attention spans. Because let's be honest, it's not only the kids who are finding it increasingly difficult to concentrate for longer periods of time. Even these days, when you watch a long form YouTube video, you will get adverts every 10, 15 minutes because the content creator needs to make some money. So what that is doing is telling your brain, telling your attention span, that things will change every 10 or 15 minutes. So even we as adults are subject to that. So let's have a think then about what we can do to promote literacy. We have seen why it's important. You know, we've talked about China. We have talked about that change in the culture that can come just by increasing literacy rates. So let's now take a look at why children feel the way that they do and what we can do to change that. So I was sent an article this morning by Tim, who is a long-term friend of the show. Thank you, Tim, if you are listening, for sending that through to me. I very much appreciate it. This is an article from The Guardian, and it cites Cassie Chatterton, who is the CEO of World Book Day, and her opinions on children's reading. And a lot of what Cassie has to say is quite shocking. So right here at the top of the article, she says, children have told us that they think reading choices are judged by the adults around them. It discourages them. It puts them off reading for pleasure and by choice. Now, of course, as an adult who encourages reading with children, my instinct is to go, no, that's not true. That's not true. You know, we don't put children off of reading. But actually, children's reading choices are judged. How many times have we heard stories of a child going and picking up a comic or a magazine and being told that they can't read it because it's not a book? When really, we should be encouraging them to read whatever it is they want to read. This isn't about dumbing down. This isn't about, you know, comics being easier to read than novels. They are. It's about choice. And it's about reminding our children that actually reading is supposed to be a pleasurable activity. We know that our children like to do things that are fun. We keep being told in our lessons, make it fun. And yet, with reading, for some reason, we gatekeep the fun and we say, no. Reading doesn't have to be fun. You know, reading has to be an intellectual academic exercise. And it really doesn't. It really doesn't. It can be fun. So let your child pick up a comic, let them pick up a magazine, let them flick through their FIFA sticker album and read the player stats, because they're reading and they are understanding the entertainment and the joy and the knowledge that can be gained from words in whatever form they are in. There's a survey cited in this article. I'll tweet the article out at the end of the show so that you can read it for yourselves if you're interested. There was a survey by Beano Brain conducted in January of 1,000 children aged 7 to 14. There we go. And this survey very cleverly asked children about their parents' hobbies. Only 25% of the respondents said that their parents relax by reading at home. 56% said that their parents scroll on their phones to relax. And 52% said that their parents watch TV to relax. One 11-year-old in the survey who identifies as a non-reader said, "Adults usually tell you to read, but then they go on their phones. My teachers and my dad do that." And that's really sad. That's really sad because what we are doing by not modelling good reading practice with children is telling them that reading is something that children do. Reading is something that is beneath adults. And what do all children want? They want to be treated like adults. So if children think that reading is childish, if children think that reading is not an adult activity, they're not going to want to do it because they want to be seen as grown up and mature. Whereas if we model good reading practices, if we explain that reading is something that grown-ups do, then maybe that will encourage them. That's not something that is very easy to do in schools. You know, outside of literacy strategies within individual schools, outside of, you know, let's all sit and read for 20 minutes in tutor time, or let's go to the library in English, it is really difficult to model good reading practices. But it is something that we should attempt to work into our curricula. I don't. And I should. I have a whole skill. In MFL, 25% of our GCSE is reading. In classics, well, let's be honest, it's all reading, isn't it? It's all reading for comprehension or translation. And yet, I very rarely in my lessons model myself reading in my foreign languages. I am more likely to be teaching my kids how to read comprehension texts so that they can get through their exam. And this is, as always, where the dichotomy of our profession comes into play, because we are attempting all the time to model good life skills and get them their qualifications. And unfortunately, while the two should be the same, they're not. So I know that what I need to do as part of my practice is figure out how I can demonstrate good reading for pleasure in my classes and pointing out that there are some wonderful books written in Latin, in ancient Greek, in French, in German, in Mandarin, because there are. But I need to figure out how I can tie that to what I actually have to teach them in terms of my subject content. So I am going to do that. I am going to try and figure that out, because I don't like to be a hypocrite. I don't want to sit here and tell you all to do that and then not do it myself. So that's one of my plans for the summer. And maybe we'll do a follow-up in the autumn, assuming, of course, that that I've not been kicked off of Teachers Talk Radio by the autumn. You know, I never take my slot here for granted. But maybe we'll catch up then and see whether I've been able to do that. But of course, it's not just about us as teachers, you know, it is about what's going on at home. And Big Boss Man Tom has texted in, "Good morning to you," to say that I won't be kicked off. So that is reassuring. That is quite all right. We like to know that my show here is secure. But yeah, I mean, there is very little, I think, that we can do to change parental habits. That has got to come from somewhere else. That has got to come from the government, I suppose. That has got to come from libraries. That has got to come from a change in the public conversation about books. Which, of course, ties nicely into what John was saying in the news about that change in public conversation about education. I do think that if we had a bigger push in this country for lifelong learning, and that it wasn't so expensive, I dread to think how much I'm going to end up spending to get my doctorate, not going to lie. Then I do actually think we would change that culture for the better. This survey by Beano Brain said that more of a quarter of respondents said that they would enjoy reading more if it were made more fun, and if there was less nagging from grown-ups. 25% of children went on to say that they are encouraged to read books that they don't want to read. A primary school teacher, Alice Reed, is quoted here as saying, "I've had a child in the classroom who had the book they wanted me to see that they were reading, and underneath that, the book that they wanted to read. They're hiding these books anyway. It's important to see that it's a valuable book. It might be one that's giving them comfort. It might be their easy read. It might have characters that they relate to. It's important as practitioners in the classroom that we're not voicing our opinion about whether it's a book that you should be reading." And again, this is where the very strict control of the national curriculum comes into play, because the national curriculum and exam specifications, they give us quite rigid reading lists, quite often quite often the reading lists are aimed at pupils who are not ready for those stories. I've talked before about how it's actually quite ridiculous that Romeo and Juliet is studied at GCSE, because you can't talk about it. Yes, the GCSE students are slightly older than Romeo and Juliet are. They're about the same age as Romeo and a little bit older than Juliet. But you can't really get to grips with Romeo and Juliet when you are 13, 14. And that's why so many people think it's a love story instead of a tragedy, because they read it at the wrong time. And I think if we tested children less on reading, and if we just let them read, and if we were allowed to say, you know, read whatever book you want to read and then tell me about it. Yes, write me an essay about it, because we think about things through writing. But that's how you're going to tell me, and I'm going to mark you on that, and that's going to be part of your grade. Would we see literacy rates increase? Would we see general well-being get better because children were allowed to read what they want? Because short of a primary school teacher planning 35 separate guided reading lessons, all on the child's own individual book, there's no other practical way to manage that. You know, you either have the whole class or the whole guided reading group or whatever it be reading the same text, which is not going to appeal to everybody, in which case you can give some kind of standardized test because they've all read the same thing. Or you can go, actually, I shouldn't be measuring reading through a standardized test. I should be letting the children read what they want to read and then seeing what they get out of it. The more I think about these sorts of things, the more I am an advocate for a portfolio-based qualification system, where you study your subjects and your qualification is given to you based on the quality of a portfolio of your work, rather than an exam that is exactly the same for everybody that doesn't actually help you to pursue your interests. But that's a whole different show, I think. So all of this is contributing to these very low literacy rates that we have. Fiona Evans, who is the director of school programs at the NLT, also cited in this Guardian article, says that 40% of 11-year-olds from disadvantaged backgrounds are leaving school without reaching their expected levels of reading. And she says that we are currently seeing the lowest levels of enjoyment of reading that we've seen for almost 20 years, which in turn contributes to low literacy levels, particularly in children and young adults who are experiencing poverty. And this then becomes a vicious cycle, because without literacy skills, it's hard for them to create a life for themselves. They may get lower GCSE results because their literacy skills are not so refined, because anytime you have to go and sit in an exam, you are having to use your literacy skills to understand what the exam is saying. Even if you get a reader as part of your access arrangements, you are having to process and understand what you are being told, what is being read out to you, because the reader doesn't reframe it, the reader doesn't reword it. They literally just read out what is there on the page. So without good literacy, you are barred from accessing these exams that we keep telling you are so important. So you're not going to be able to go on and get the A-level results you want. You're not going to be able to go on to do your apprenticeship. You're not going to be able to go on to university. And then that becomes a cycle. And it's the same thing that the Chinese saw back in the 1920s. Obviously, here in England, it's not as severe as it was in China in the 1920s, of course, but it's the same principle. It's that same idea. This shocked me because I didn't know this. But according to Cassie Chatterton, I've not had time to fact check this, but you know, this is the CEO of World Book Day, so I'm inclined to believe her as a reliable source. There is no statutory requirement for schools to have a library. 1 in 7 primary schools do not. And that rises to 1 in 4 in disadvantaged areas. And this, I suppose, is my own privilege, because every school that I attended as a child had a library. Every school that I've taught in has had a library. And yet there is no actual requirement. Which means that if you can't afford the books to populate the library, if you can't afford the librarian to run the library, then you're probably not going to have one. And libraries, of course, are crucial. They are critical in promoting reading for pleasure because they give children a choice. We know that children like to feel in charge. We know that they like to feel in control. We know that they like to have a choice. And the library gives them that in a way that maybe we can't in the classroom. So even if, you know, my pipe dream of having a portfolio-based education system, that's not going to come true. So even if we assume that we are sticking with an exams-based system where we all have to read the same set text in class, because this is the one that I as the teacher know inside and out, because I've done all of the background reading on it, and so this is the one that I can teach you best to get you the best grade in your A-level, you can still go off to the library and choose whatever you want to read in your free time. And I think that's so important. So let's talk about libraries for a couple of minutes. Because, you know, like I said, that article that I've just been quoting, that was sent to me this morning, but I had planned to talk about libraries today because of their importance. And I found out some quite shocking things. So all of the figures that I have for you at the moment, these are pre-COVID, but it's quite interesting to look at. So in 2020, there were 3,667 public libraries serving UK communities. We know that that number is falling. My local library a couple of times has been in danger of being closed down. Thankfully, they ultimately just rehomed it instead of shutting it, and I'm very thankful for that. But we know that libraries in general are in a precarious position because of funding. There are 7.3 million active borrowers of UK libraries. These are stats gathered from the CIPFA. Now, for some comparison, there are 2 million football participants. So we actually have almost four times as many people visiting a library as actively participating in football, which is quite good, because if you were to ask people what is England's preferred pastime between reading and football, people would say football. But the stats say that that's not true. There are approximately 214 million visits to a library taking place each year, plus 131 million online visits, borrowing ebooks and audiobooks. There are almost 165 million books issued each year, and the library is more likely to be used by minority communities than white communities. So libraries are important. These figures, actually, for me, are really encouraging. I didn't think that they would be that high in terms of like the number of libraries and the number of borrowers and just kind of how important the library clearly is to the British community. I do find those stats very, very encouraging. The library is really interesting, though, isn't it, as an institution? Because it is the library that is the reading service of the UK. Your library card, which is free, represents your entitlement to literacy. It doesn't matter what your economic background is. It doesn't matter what your social status is. It doesn't matter what mistakes you have made in your life. You are entitled to a library card. And there is no cutoff point. You can sign your 1-year-old up for a library card. You can sign your 97-year-old mother up for a library card. There is no cutoff point for getting one. Libraries have become hubs for early years services. So many rhyme times and early years outreach services happen through the library. According to a 2004 study by the EPPE, these have demonstrated a causal link with early language and literacy development. You've got the socialization, you have got the trained adult leading the rhyme time, leading the story time. But you've also got your child in an environment where they are surrounded by books, where books are normalized, where books are still special, but it's understood that there are lots of them and that they are something to be enjoyed. It's that early relationship between having a book, seeing a book, seeing books around you, and having a good time. It's why reading to your child at bedtime is so important, because as your child is winding down, as your child is becoming more emotional, they will start to associate the comfort of their pajamas, their bed, their hot water bottle, their glass of water, whatever it might be, with having a book read to them. And that reinforces the positive message of books are good. And it associates reading with the dopamine hit. And again, we know how important this dopamine release is for our young people, particularly as they are being overstimulated through social media. It associates that dopamine hit with reading. And so they start reading for pleasure in order to get it. According to Clark and Hawkins, in a study published in 2011, there is strong evidence that demonstrates that libraries grow reading identity. And this is a really interesting topic. The idea that you create and carve your identity as a reader, this is becoming very common on social media, I'm noticing. If you have a look at the BookTube, Bookstagram, BookTok communities, you see people start to identify as types of readers. I'm a middle grade reader, or I'm a middle grade account. I'm a romanticy reader. That is their reading identity. And, you know, we want our children to read broadly. We want our children to be exposed to a range of ideas, because that's how they will form their own conclusions about things. But there's nothing wrong with having a reading identity. There is nothing wrong with saying, I am predominantly a reader of this genre. I am predominantly a reader of this type of book. One in 11 of the poorest children in this country do not own a book of their own. And so they are totally reliant on public and school libraries. That was a study done by Clark in 2021. I'm just going to repeat that because that's quite shocking. One in 11 of the poorest children do not own their own book. It is completely understandable, because if you are a family on the breadline and all of your money is going out to food and heating and, you know, the essentials to physically stay alive, then you're not going to spend that money on books, particularly when the library is available. So this isn't actually me kind of looking down on people who don't have books in their house, because that's part of what the library is for, you know, and this is why libraries are so important and need more funding. They're also very good places for adult learners to engage. You know, I've spoken about that lifelong love of learning. I've spoken about why it is very important to keep reading, to demonstrate reading. If you are not a confident reader as an adult, you can learn. You can become more confident. In the same way that if you want to bodybuild, you will go to the gym and work on gym machines. I assume they all have names, I'm not sure. You can go to the library and you can build your reading muscle. You know, so it doesn't stop. It doesn't have to stop. Clark and Hawkins, back in 2011, had some interesting stats about reading levels of types of users. So, of people who are at below the expected reading level for their age, 36.7% used the public library, 63.3% did not. Of pupils studied in this study who were at expected reading levels for their age, 48.9% used the library, 51.1% did not. And of pupils who were above expected reading levels for their age, 64.5% used the library, 35.5% did not. So what we have is this idea. And it makes sense that children who use the library regularly are reading at above their expected age level, because they probably get more practice. Now, that's not necessarily true. I mean, I didn't get a library card until I was 10, I think it was. So I didn't use our public library very regularly as a young child. But I did have books. I was very lucky in that my parents prioritized having books for me. So, you know, it's not true for every individual, but as a general range, that makes sense, because children who are using the public library, and of course making use of it, not just checking a book out and not reading it, they are reading more often. And so they are training that muscle. They are training their ability to read. Kuzera, Field, and Windisch in 2016 published a paper that reported that 16.4% of adults in England, which was approximately 7.1 million individuals, had poor literacy skills. Low levels of literacy are intergenerational, and they emerge before a child starts school. Children in the most deprived areas are already 11 months behind their peers in their literacy skills when they start at primary school. And now that there are issues with closing the gap funding, that's just going to start widening, according to the Sutton Trust. 42% of disadvantaged children leave primary school unable to read well, compared to 27% of advantaged children. Those are stats by the DfE, published in 2019. And only 40% of disadvantaged children achieve a good GCSE in English, compared to 64% of more advantaged children. Those figures were published in 2018. So again, by not prioritizing literacy, we are stopping children from getting the grade that they need in English in order to get onto whatever it is that they want to do later. By not promoting literacy, by not prioritizing literacy, we are creating barriers that do not need to be created. We are creating barriers to learning. We are creating barriers to a future. Adults with functional literacy skills earn 16% more than those without. A survey by British Land in 2021 suggests that if every child read for pleasure, and there was then a followed path of gaining functional literacy skills through that, then we could add £4.6 billion a year to the UK's GDP. That surely should be something that the government is interested in. Adults with level one literacy skills, so kind of, again, basic functional literacy, have a 6% higher probability of finding a job than those who have entry level three skills, so just below functional literacy. Nearly two-thirds of people going into the UK prison service were assessed of having the literacy skills expected of an 11-year-old, and more than more than four times higher than that of the general adult population. That was according to the Prison Reform Trust. People with low health literacy, compared to the general population, are 1.5 to 3 times more likely to experience increased hospitalisation or death, according to a PHE survey in 2015. Gilbert et al. In 2018 published a study that said the life expectancy gap between the wards with the highest and lowest literacy is 26 years. 26 years can be added on average to life by having high literacy skills. Now, why is that? Because obviously being able to read doesn't give you magical immunity boosting powers. But what it does do, is it gives you access to the resources that you might need to get better. When I got my depression and anxiety diagnosis a few years ago,
First thing I did before I spoke to my doctor about therapy, before I spoke to my doctor about medication, was I went on Amazon and I bought every secondhand book I could find about depression and anxiety so that I could read about it, so that I could understand what was actually happening to me. And yes, you know, my doctor explained things, my therapist explained things, the pharmacist explained things, but I was able to get a broader knowledge of what I was going through because I could access other people's ideas. Education is socially constructed. Education is about taking a broad range of ideas and synthesizing them. If I cannot access all of this extra information and I'm only taking for read what I am being told by one doctor and by one therapist and by one pharmacist, I'm only able to be on a very narrow pathway towards recovery. Which again is not me saying that every time you have an illness, you should go straight onto Google and look up your symptoms instead of going to the doctor. It's me saying that literacy isn't about reading for reading's sake. You know, I've spent a lot of this show today talking about reading for pleasure, but actually what we have to keep in mind is the fact that reading is fundamental for everything. Reading allows you to pursue whatever it is you need to pursue. Reading can help you find more information about whatever it is you're going through. And literacy, having skills, knowing not just how to read, but how to process what you are reading, how to discriminate between the propaganda and the, in inverted commas, non-propaganda, I suppose. By understanding how to read a text and think, what is this author's bias? What does this person want me to think? And how does that impact the way that they are phrasing what they're telling me? Because that's all literacy. You know, those types of English skills, they are literacy, but they help us to become well-informed, well-rounded, healthy, higher earning adults. Because I, where possible, I like to declare my bias in the show. You know, again, at the top of the show, I told you that I am biased because I strongly believe in literacy. I strongly believe in reading. I believe in stories. You know, I'm a reader. I'm a linguist. I'm a classicist. I'm an actor. I believe in stories. But not everybody will declare their bias. And not everybody is aware of their bias. There are bound to be lots of other biases that I have had in this show while talking to you about this that I haven't thought about. Like the fact that I'm just blindly kind of citing these studies because I trust the people who wrote them. That's a bias. You know, I trust that these people who know more about this stuff than I do are telling me the truth. And that's a bias. But we need those skills. We need those critical reading skills so that we can stop just blindly believing things, which is also not to go the other way and not believe anything ever, because that's just as bad. But to be able to synthesize our own information, synthesize the different things that we are constantly being told in a world where we are constantly being bombarded with information, and figure it out, create knowledge, be educated. Because ultimately that's what literacy kind of boils down to, isn't it? Is being educated. But I am going to loop back round to reading for enjoyment just as we finish off the show, because that's honestly what the bulk of today's show has been about, hasn't it? And it is where we start with literacy. It is, because if we can get children reading for pleasure, if we can get adults reading for pleasure, then all the lessons that we teach them in school about critical reading, about comprehension,
about imagination, about style. Those will all be practiced outside of the classroom, and that's what we want. That's the point of homework, isn't it? To get children practicing what's in class outside. And that's exactly what reading for pleasure can do for all subjects. The OECD in 2022 published something called Reading for Change, and they said enjoyment of reading has a greater impact on a child's educational achievement than their parents' socioeconomic status. So, you know, quite often in educational research, we look at socioeconomic status, we look at, you know, deprived areas versus not so much. But actually, what we can quite often separate our children into are the groups of those who read for pleasure and those who don't, those who like reading and those who don't. And it's quite interesting then to compare those statistics. Sullivan and Brown said, children's leisure reading is important for educational attainment and social mobility. And whether we like it or not, in this country, we are still a little bit obsessed with social mobility. The idea of, you know, escaping your station. The key thing, I think, that is important for us to talk about, or that is important for us to take away from this show, is this idea that children need to enjoy reading. Children enjoy doing what they perceive to be grown-up things. So if we reframe reading as a grown-up pursuit, if they see their parents reading, if they see their teachers reading, they might be more likely to read. And they need to be able to read what they want. They need to be able to have their own choice of what they read. And quite often, the reason that we gatekeep children's books, the reason that we gatekeep what our children are reading, yes, is because of exams, you know, yes, because of the reading scheme that we're using, and it tells us that they need to follow these books. And, you know, I understand that. But also, it's because even as teachers and even as people who are, you know, involved in literature, we still quite often misunderstand children's literature, I feel. There is still this idea that children's literature is remedial, that it lacks literary merit. There is still sometimes a snobbery around reading, isn't there? Let's be honest. Where if a book is fun, if it's enjoyable, if it's not trying to change the world, but just to tell a good story, then it doesn't have any merit. And that's quite often what children's books try and do. They just try to be entertaining. They try to make the child laugh. They try to make the child imagine. Quite often they have a moral. Quite often they have a point, I guess. But sometimes entertainment can be the point. Not everything has to be high social change literature. Sometimes you can just want to have a good time. And particularly if you've got a child who is a reluctant reader, it's important that they have a good time. I also think that there has been a shift in children's books more recently than we would like to acknowledge, which means that as adults, we quite often don't know how to approach them. And I don't think that there have been enough studies published about modern children's literature. So if we look at children's literature, particularly books that were pushed in schools before the 1960s, and this information comes from the US, but we can apply it to the UK as well. We are looking at things like, in the US, we were looking at things like Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys and Tom Swift. We were looking at books that were kind of milquetoast. They avoided serious issues. They avoided anything controversial. And they were written for a very middle-class white audience, perhaps whose parents didn't want them to be exposed to the social reality. And of course, it's that sort of thing that has led to this preconception of children's literature as being not particularly good. Just for entertainment, has no literary merit. Because before the 1960s, authors weren't allowed to write anything for children that tried to change society. They were, the books were written to be just entertaining. But now the tide has turned so that books for children are not allowed to be just entertaining anymore. Children have to take life lessons away from absolutely everything. And we don't really know how to respond to that. Because children want to read things that are fun. And so I think there is a clash between what children's writers are writing, what children's publishers are publishing, what children's parents want them to read, and what children's teachers want them to read. And the children can't win. The children cannot win. Because they are lumped in the middle with all of these conflicting things being told to them about what they should read. And in the midst of it all, they're still not allowed to read what they want to, because they feel judged. Going back to that Guardian article from the beginning, they feel judged by what they read. What do we do about it? We take away the judgment. We accept, we understand that all reading is reading. We understand that the days of us sitting in the bathroom reading the back of a shampoo bottle are gone because kids are taking their phones to the bathroom and scrolling TikTok instead. So even, you know, what we did that we thought was just wasting time because we were bored, it was reading. It was practicing those literacy skills. It was practicing our scansion. It was practicing our ability to take in and retain information. And that has gone away. Doesn't exist anymore. We can't pretend that it does. We have to face that. And so if children are not passively reading, if children are not reading because there is literally nothing else for them to do, we need to get them to read with purpose. And why are they going to read with purpose? Because they enjoy what they're reading. So there we go. This whole show today turned into a bit of a soapbox. Didn't mean it to. I thought it was going to be quite a nice, subdued discussion about why literacy is important. But as I say quite often on the show, I quite like taking you on my own learning journey with me. Because, you know, yes, as I've said, you know, you shouldn't read anything without writing about it. You don't learn without writing. But speaking can do the same thing. And I think I've changed my own mind across the course of the show today. I still think that literacy is incredibly important. But what I think I have realized is that we need to almost unschool literacy. We need to stop making it academic, particularly for our children, and particularly for our young children, and just make it fun. And just make sure that they know that they can read to get information and they can read to be entertained. And if we push just a culture of reading in this country, as we have seen by looking at the history of China very briefly, as we have seen by many of those studies that I've talked about, we will be able to improve what our country is, which ultimately is kind of the point of education in a capitalist society, isn't it? Is so that we can get better, so that we can profit, so that society profits. And there we go. That is us for today. As always, thank you to everybody who has tuned in, who has listened, who has interacted. There is no show for me next week because I am teaching. So I will be back in 2 weeks' time to share breakfast with you. I cannot wait. My favourite time of the week, as you know, is always this Saturday morning when I get to chat to you. So I will do that then. Please do stay tuned. We have got some awesome stuff coming up over the next 2 weeks. And if you miss me next week, as always, do go back through the archive on Spotify, on Podbean, on the Teachers Talk Radio website, because I've got a whole back catalogue of things that you can catch up on. Thank you very much to everybody who has been here today, and have yourselves a great weekend. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.